Hachette Audio presents 14th Deadly Sin, written by James Patterson and Maxine Petro, read by January Lavoie. For Susie and John, Brendan, Alex, and Jack. Part 1. Chapter 1. It was a blindingly sunny morning in May, and Joe Molinari was out for a walk in the park with Martha, his smart and funny dog, and Julie, his adorable 9-month-old baby girl. Julie was in a sling, her belly against her great big daddy's chest, looking over his shoulder and waving her fingers toward the lake, with every confidence that she was making real words and that her dad would be happy to take direction.
"Do you have a license to point those things?" Joe said to the child.
"Damn right,"
Joe replied in his best imitation of how Julie would speak if she could.
"We all know who's in charge here, Daddy. I only need to point and babble. Race you to the bench by the ducks."
Joe ruffled Julie's hair and got a better grip on Martha's leash as he took in the scene again. He ran his eyes across the path to the bench, checking out the people with dogs and strollers, the shadows between the trees, and the traffic beyond the glare of the water. Then he paused to double-check a middle-aged guy smoking a cigarette, staring deep into his phone. These were the habits of a former federal agent, and until recently, the deputy director of Homeland Security. He was now a consultant, specializing in risk management assessment for big corporations, government agencies, and other authorities. Currently, Joe was 6 months into a job he'd been working 18 hours a day, mainly from his office in the spare bedroom. It was a complex project, an obstacle course of practical and political complications. He felt fine about how it was coming along, and he also felt good about the lay of the land as he settled onto an empty bench with a fine, ducky view of the lake. Julie laughed and beat the air with her hands as he unstrapped her from the sling and sat her on his lap. Martha came over and tried to wash Julie's face before Joe interceded and pulled the border collie to his side. Julie loved Martha and giggled a long peal of baby talk just as Joe's cell phone rang. It wasn't Lindsay's ring. Pawing his shirt pocket, he saw that the caller was Brooks Finley, the exec who'd commissioned his assignment with the Port of Los Angeles. Joe pictured the man, a former college football player, fit, thinning blonde hair, dimples. It was odd to get a call from Finley first thing in the morning, but Joe answered the phone. Finley said,
"Joe, it's Brooks Finley. Is this a good time to talk?"
Finley's voice was shaded by a dull, metallic tone that put Joe on alert. What the hell is wrong with Finley? Chapter 2.
"I'm free to talk," Joe said to Finley, "but I'm not at my computer."
"Not a problem," said Finley. "Look, Joe, I've got to terminate our arrangement. It's just not working out. You know how it is."
"Actually, I don't know," Joe said. "What's the problem? I don't understand."
A crowd of young boys entered Joe's field of vision, shouting to one another, kicking a soccer ball along the asphalt path. At the same time, the baby was giving Joe a new set of directions. He kept his hand on her tummy and hoped she didn't start screaming.
Julie could scream. "Brooks, can you hear me okay? I've put a lot of time into this project. I deserve an explanation and a chance to correct..."
"Thanks, Joe, but it's out of my hands. We'll take it from here, okay? Your confidentiality contract is in effect, of course, and, your check's in the mail. Listen, I've got incoming. Gotta sign off. Take care."
The line went dead. Joe held the phone for a few long moments before he returned it to his pocket. Wow. No apologies. Not even a face-saving explanation. Just a needlessly brutal chop. Joe reviewed his last conversations with Finley, looking for clues to something he might have missed, some hint of a complaint, but nothing lit up the board. Actually, Finley had seemed happy with his work.
And Joe was sure his preliminary analysis of the container security protocols at the Port of Los Angeles was solid. He really hadn't seen this coming. After pushing through the initial shock and confusion, Joe glimpsed his new reality. First, there would be the loss of income, then the humiliation of having to explain this sinkhole to the next guy interviewing him for a job. That thought was just about intolerable. He wanted to call Lindsay, but on the other hand, why ruin her day too?
"Hey, Julie," Joe said to his now fussing daughter. "Can you believe it? Daddy got fired. Over the phone. Bang."
Joe buckled the baby back into her sling, and she reached up and touched his cheek.
"I'm okay, Julianne. I'm thinking we should all go home now. I'm in the mood for a banana smoothie. Sound good to you?"
Julie looked like she was going to cry. His little girl was mirroring his feelings. Joe said,
"Okay, okay, sweetie, don't cry. We can come back and see the ducks later. We can come back every day into the foreseeable future.
I can put peaches in that smoothie, all right? You like peaches."
"I sure do, Daddy," Joe said in his baby voice.
He swept his gaze around the park and then stood up with Julie.
"You ready, Martha? That's a girl."
She woofed and jumped, so he gave her the full length of her leash till they were leaving the park, then pulled the lead in for the couple of blocks toward home. By then, Joe wasn't thinking of fruit and ice and yogurt. He was thinking of Finley, pressing that gutless piece of crap through the blender. Chapter 3. I was behind my desk that morning as light streamed through the Bryant Street windows and slashed across the squad room's linoleum floor. My partner, Inspector Rich Conklin, was standing behind me to my right, and Chief of Police Warren Jacoby loomed impatiently over my left shoulder. Jacoby had caught a couple of bullets in his leg and hip a few years ago, and the injuries had aged him. He was 50 pounds overweight, his joints crackled and popped when he walked, and the pain had drained the fun from his salty sense of humor. He grumbled,
"Wait till you see this,"
and handed me a disc. Then he sighed loudly as we waited for my lazy-ass computer to boot up. I slid the disc into the drawer. The drive whirred, and then a video, time-dated 3:06 this morning, appeared on my screen. The camera had been positioned under flickering streetlights in a nearly deserted block in the notoriously sketchy Tenderloin. The footage was grainy, shot with a cheap surveillance cam of the type used more as a prop than as a tool for actually identifying people.
"That's Ellis Street,"
said Jacoby.
"And that's what I call crud,"
he added, stabbing a sausage-like finger at three figures entering the frame. The men wore black-billed caps and navy blue windbreakers with white letters reading SFPD across the back. They also held automatic handguns as they headed smartly toward an all-night check cashing store with a yellow sign above the window reading Payday Loans, Checks Cashed. I straightened in my seat, then turned to shoot a look at Jacoby. "What the hell is this?"
"Balls on these bastards,"
he said.
"Boxer. It's hard to make out. Can't you focus that picture?"
"What you see is what you get," I said. For long, gritty seconds, we watched the cops advance along the dark commercial street lined with low, blocky buildings. Then they converged on the lit-up storefront and went through the door in single file. A moment later, the lights inside the store went out. The door burst open, and one of the cops ran out with a satchel under one arm, followed by the other two men who were carrying similar bags. Now that they were heading toward the camera, I looked for facial features, something that could be run through facial recognition software. But the faces were all the same. Then I got it. The bad guys were wearing latex masks that completely disguised their features. Seconds after leaving the store, the men in the SFPD windbreakers had run out of camera range. Jacoby said,
"Christ. Someone please tell me that these men are anything but cops."
Chapter 4. I felt sickened at what I had just seen on the footage. Like Jacoby, I hoped we were looking at hold-up guys with a bad sense of humor, not actual police officers pulling off an armed robbery. I asked Jacoby, were there any fatalities?
One,
he said.
The owner wouldn't give up the combination to the safe until he was shot to pieces. He managed a few words with the EMTs before he bled out on the floor. He said cops did it. The kid who worked for him was interviewed on scene. He said there had been about 60 grand in the floor safe.
Conklin whistled. Jacoby went on.
This is the second one like this. A few days ago, three men in SFPD caps and windbreakers robbed a Spanish market, a mercado. No one died, but it was another big score. It goes without saying these guys have to be stopped, or every man and woman in uniform is going to take shit for this, whether we deserve it or not.
Conklin and I nodded, and Jacoby kept going.
Robbery squad is already working the case, but I told Brady, I want the two of you to work with them now that we've got a homicide. Boxer, you know Philip Pekelny, who heads up robbery? Call him. You and Conklin work with his guys. This is the most important case in the house.
We've got it, Chief. Muttering to himself, Jacoby stumped out of the bullpen. About now, robbery would be canvassing Ellis Street, and forensics would be taking apart a check cashing shop called Payday Loans, Checks Cashed. All we could hope for was a snitch, or that this professional crew had left evidence behind. I called Phil Pekelny and repeated Jacoby's instructions. The sergeant told me what he knew about the case so far.
The scene is still off limits,
Phil said.
CSU has barred the doors until they're done, which could be later today.
Phil told me he would get us the footage of the first windbreaker heist, the armed robbery of a mercado.
It's with the DA's office, but I'll put in a request to get a copy to you ASAP.
I called administration and asked for timesheets for every cop at every rank in the southern station, thinking maybe we could at least make a list of cops who were off duty when those heists went down. And for me, question number one was, were these robbers really cops or just crooks in cops' clothing? Either way, wearing police windbreakers probably gave the robbers a few seconds grace before the victims knew they were being hit. My good-doing partner made a breakfast burrito run, and I put up a fresh pot of coffee in the break room. Then we settled into our facing desks, ready for a roll-up-your-sleeves desktop investigation. Chapter 5. Hours after talking with Phil Pekelny, Conklin and I were still waiting for the DA's office to send over the video of the Windbreaker cop's first known heist. I checked my watch. I could still make it. I told my partner I'd be back in a couple of hours. I have a date, and I can't be late. Richie opened his desk drawer, pulled out a slim, brightly wrapped package with a bow and a gift card, and handed it to me.
This is for Claire. Try to bring me back some cake.
He grinned winningly. He's a handsome guy who has somehow avoided becoming vain. I took the gift, as well as the one I'd stashed inside my top drawer, then got my car out of the lot across the street. Two twisted streets and 10 minutes later, I parked my ancient Explorer at the curb in front of the Bay Club. I put my ID on the dash. Then I walked around the corner to Marlowe, a fabulous eatery housed in a brick building with wine and food quotes etched on the large paned casement windows. I peered through the glass and saw Yuki and Claire in the back at a table for four. They seemed intensely involved in conversation, and from the looks on their faces, they were taking opposite sides. I came through the door into the bright, industrial-style interior, and Yuki spotted me right away. It almost looked like she was hoping for rescue. She called out over the loud conversation that was bouncing off the tile and steel surfaces.
Lindsay, over here!
I headed toward my pals, and Claire stood up for my hug. She looked gorgeous, wearing black pants, a V-neck sweater, and a diamond pendant shaped like a butterfly around her neck. Claire is usually trying to lose a few pounds, but she always looks perfect to me. I said,
love you, butterfly. Happy birthday, girlfriend.
She laughed.
Love you too, Linz.
She hugged me back, and I swung into a chair across from her and next to Yuki. Small-boned Yuki was impeccably dressed in a blue suit, her sleek hair falling to her creamy silk collar. A string of pale, angel-skin coral beads at her throat. When I'd last seen Yuki a week ago, she'd looked a little happier than she did now.
You okay?
I asked.
I'm good, she said.
We embraced, and I had just hung my jacket over the back of my chair when Cindy sailed up to the table, glowing like a rose at sunrise. There was more hugging and kissing all around, Cindy adding a gift to the growing pile of sparkly paper and ribbons in the center of the table. We high-fived each other, and I signaled to the waiter. I was hungry for the specialty of the house. A hamburger made with Nyman Ranch beef, topped with caramelized onions, bacon, cheese, and horseradish aioli, nestled between halves of a hot, buttered bun. With fries. And even more than that upcoming delight, I was very glad to be with my best friends. It was Cindy who had named our little group the Women's Murder Club. It was kind of a joke and, at the same time, entirely for real, because the four of us certainly surrounded the subject of murder. Me and homicide. Claire, San Francisco's medical examiner. Yuki, a rising star in the DA's office. And Cindy Thomas, a top-tier crime reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Cindy was a new author, too. Her nonfiction book, Fish's Girl, a true story of love and serial murder, was grounded in a case Conklin and I had worked and two killers we had both known very well. Cindy had followed up the case and helped bring one of those killers down. Her book was coming out at the end of the week. I was pretty sure that was why she was glowing. After we'd ordered drinks, Claire piped up, Yuki's quitting her job. Cindy and I both said,
no way,
at the same time.
I'm thinking about it, Yuki said. Just thinking about it. It's like an idea, you know? Geesh, you guys.
Cindy jumped in with what I was imagining.
Oh, my God. I know what's going on with you.
You're pregnant.
Yuki was married to my boss, the tough but fair Lieutenant Jackson Brady. But they'd only been married for 4 months. I didn't have a chance to get my mind around the idea of Yuki and Brady having a child, because Yuki was answering Cindy in her typical rapid-fire style.
No, I'm not pregnant. But if you don't mind, all of you, we have to order lunch now, because I absolutely have to be in a deposition in an hour.
And that was when my phone rang. I looked at the caller ID while everyone stared bullets at me. We had one rule for our no-holds-barred get-togethers. No phone calls.
Sorry, I said. I've got to take this.
And I did. Chapter 6. I left the girls and found a niche where I could take the call in private. What's wrong? I said to Lieutenant Brady.
A dead body at 24th and Balmy Alley, he said. I need you and Conklin to do a preliminary workup. Lock down the scene and sit tight until replacements arrive. Jacoby wants you and Conklin on the check cashing heist. Nothing else.
I rejoined my friends. I said, sorry, guys. That was the boss. I've got to go. Yuki tossed her napkin a few inches into the air in exasperation. Cindy said,
what can you tell me?
You can take the reporter out of the Chronicle, but you can't take the reporter out of Cindy.
Nothing, I said.
I can't tell you even one little thing.
How many times do I have to prove I'm trustworthy?
Said Cindy.
Plus, you owe me.
Actually, Cindy was right. On both counts. I trusted her, and a few months ago, she'd saved my life.
I still can't tell you anything. Not a word.
I grabbed for my jacket and had just about secured it when Claire said,
I cannot believe this is happening again.
The expression on her face stopped me. She was pissed. Highly. What's happening again? I asked her.
This is almost exactly what happened last year on my birthday, said Claire. And the year before that.
Are you sure?
I'm damned sure. Although, as I recall, last year we actually ate most of our lunch before you bolted from the table. Check your memory, Lindsay. When was the last time you saw me blow out the candles?
I'm sorry. I can't get out of this. I'll make it up to you, Claire, to everyone, including myself. That's an ironclad promise. I apologized some more, blew kisses, and fled the restaurant. I called Rich Conklin from the street, and while I walked to my car, I said, I'm 10 minutes away.
Same here.
The engine started right up. I peeled out and pointed the Explorer toward a busy intersection in the Mission. Chapter 7. Balmy Alley and 24th looked like a freeway pileup. I counted 3 hastily parked cruisers, and another one was coming in behind me. Both streets were cordoned off, causing traffic to back up in the one open lane on 24th. Pedestrians had gathered 3 deep at the barrier tape with cell phones in hand, evidently having nothing better to do than gawp at a bleeding corpse in the crosswalk. I parked on the sidewalk, got my point-and-shoot Nikon out of the console, and found Conklin, who was talking to a young cop. He introduced me to Officer Martin Einhorn, a rookie who'd been writing up a parking ticket when the incident occurred. Einhorn's black eyes flashed back and forth between Conklin and me as he walked us through the scene. He was sweating through his uniform, and his speech was high-pitched and staccato. Very likely he'd never seen a body before, and now he'd been this close to an actual murder as it happened. He said,
I was putting a ticket on that red Mazda over there. The victim was crossing the street. There were a lot of people crossing at the same time, both ways.
Tourists, mostly, he said, pointing his chin in the general direction of the sightseer magnet, vividly colored murals protesting human rights abuses over the last 50 years.
I didn't see the attack, said the rookie. I heard the screaming, and when everyone scattered, I saw her.
He took a moment to get himself together before continuing.
I called it in, and the EMTs got here like a minute later. They said the victim was dead, and I told them to leave her body in place, that this is a crime scene.
Exactly right, I said. Einhorn nodded, then said a squad car had arrived after a few minutes, and the officers had strung tape.
We got as many names as we could, but people were trying to get out of here, and we didn't have enough manpower to detain them. Those 2 witnesses hung in, Mr. and Mrs. Nathan Goslin, right over there. Mrs. Goslin saw the attack.
While Conklin approached the couple standing outside a smoke shop, I took a wide-angle view of the crime scene and got a fix on where the victim lay in relation to cars, buildings, and people. Then I ducked under the tape and identified myself to the officers who were protecting the body and the scene. One of the cops said,
Right this way, Sergeant. Mind the blood.
Got it, I said. I gloved up, then moved closer so that I could get a good look at the victim. Chapter 8. It was a terrible sight. The dead woman was lying on her side. She was white, had shoulder-length brown hair, and looked to be in her late 40s or early 50s. She had cared about her appearance and wore expensive clothing, an unbuttoned tan raincoat over blood-soaked beige knit separates. The source of the blood looked to be a long slice through her clothes from her lower abdomen up to her ribcage that had likely required strength, determination, and a long, sharp blade. The victim had bled out fast. She might never have known what had happened to her. I trained my camera on the conspicuous wound. Then I shot close-ups of the victim's hands, no wedding band, and of her face and of her stockinged feet, which lay like beached fish where she'd fallen out of her shoes. An authentic and pricey large Louis Vuitton handbag lay beside her. I opened the bag and photographed the contents. A pair of good running shoes, a makeup kit, a Jimmy Choo sunglass case, a paperback novel, and a brown leather wallet, new and of good quality. When I opened her wallet, I learned that the victim's name was Tina Strickler. Her driver's license listed her age as 52, and her home address was about 6 blocks from the scene of her death. Strickler had a full deck of credit cards and business cards identifying her as a psychiatrist. She also had receipts for recent purchases and $222 in cash. I typed Strickler's name into my phone, using an app that linked up to SFPD databases, and got nothing back, which didn't surprise me. So far, I had nothing to explain why this woman of means had not been robbed. She'd been gutted in broad daylight on a busy street where cell phone cameras were pointing in every direction. I circled the body and took photos of the crowd on the sidewalks, on the chance that whoever had killed this woman was watching the activity at the crime scene. Conklin came toward me and summarized the witness statements, using his hands to point out the direction the victim had been coming from.
"The Goslins were crossing Balmy Alley toward the victim," he said. "Mrs. Goslin didn't notice the killer until he struck or punched out at the victim's midsection. All she saw was a medium-sized white guy in a black jacket or coat, or shirt with the tails out. She thinks he had brown hair."
Conklin looked exasperated, and I felt the same way. So many pairs of eyes, and one of the only two witnesses had seen practically nothing. My partner went on.
"After the attack, the doer kept going and disappeared into the crowd. Mr. Goslin saw none of this. He went to his wife when she started screaming. The rest was chaos, a stampede."
An unmarked car pulled up and two guys from our squad got out, Fred Michaels and Alex Wang, both new hires by Brady. Conklin and I greeted them and brought them up to date on the details of the crime as we knew it. I told them I'd send them a typed version of my notes and the photos as soon as I got back to the hall. And then, as sorry as I was to do it, I turned the case over to the new guys. Conklin and I had our own horrible murder waiting for us at our desks. We got back into our separate cars and were headed back to the hall when, as I turned onto Bryant Street, something came to me. It was a realization that just about reached out and hit me like a slap across the face. Claire had been right. There had been murders on each of her birthdays for the previous 2 years. And I was almost positive that those cases hadn't been solved. Chapter 9. When the wretched day finally ended and I came through the front door of our apartment, Martha wiggled her butt, barked, and sang me an excited welcome home song. I hugged her, held her front paws, and danced a few steps with her. Then I called out to Joe. He called back.
"I'm giving Julie a bath."
"Okay, then." I hung up my jacket, kicked off my shoes, and put my gun in the cabinet, locking it up. I walked with Martha to the open kitchen of our airy apartment on Lake Street, where I'd come to live with Joe as his bride. A year later, this was where I gave birth to Julie during a blacked-out and very stormy night while Joe was out of town. That was at the top of the list of the most memorable nights of my life. I topped up Martha's dinner bowl and poured 2 chilled glasses of Chardonnay. With Martha trailing behind me, I went to the master bathroom. I knocked, opened the door, and saw the 2 people I love the most. My smile stretched out to my ears. "Oh," I cooed. "Look how cute and clean she is." I leaned down and kissed Joe, who was kneeling beside the tub. Julie grinned her adorable face half off, lifted her arms, and squealed. I put the wine glasses on the vanity. Then I kissed Julie's hand, making funny noises in her palm. I handed Joe the pink towel that was appliqued with "Our Baby Girl." I understand that first-time parents are a little goofy, but this towel had been a gift. "I need a bath myself," I said as Joe lifted the damp baby into his arms.
"You go ahead,"
said my handsome and most wonderful husband.
"You okay with pizza pronto? I'll call in an order."
"Brilliant," I said. "Sausage, mushrooms, onions okay?"
"You forgot the jalapenos."
"Those too." The pizza arrived. Pronto. Over our down-and-dirty dinner, I told Joe about the windbreaker cops. When the pizza box was in the trash, the baby was asleep and Joe was working in his home office, aka the spare bedroom, I brought my laptop to the living room and took over the big leather sofa. I'd worked the Windbreaker Cops case at both ends of my day, but I found I couldn't stop thinking about Tina Strickler, the shrink who'd been gutted in the street. Now that I had a full belly and some free time, I felt compelled to check out the homicides that had happened on Claire's birthday the two previous years. I was almost positive that these cases had somehow slipped through the cracks. Chapter 10. My husband stood behind me, his hands working on the clenched muscles in my neck.
"Ooh, I think I like working at home," I said.
"Yes, well, I'm the legendary man with the slow hands."
I laughed.
"Yes, you are.
More wine?"
"No, thanks. I'm good."
"Okay, then,"
he said, giving my shoulders a squeeze.
"Martha and I are going for a run."
"I'll wait up."
As soon as Joe and Martha had left the apartment, I checked on our sleeping little one, and then I went back to work. I typed in my password and opened the SFPD case log to kick off my search. The index to the files was little more than a list of the victims. Each case was dated and marked either active, closed, or pending. The name of the lead inspector on each case was listed under the victim's name. Since I was searching for murders on specific dates, it didn't take long to find the two women who'd been killed on Claire's birthday. I stared at the names, and I remembered the occasions. Just the way it had happened today, I'd been called from the table to go to the crime scene because I was a ranking officer on duty and near the location when the body had been discovered. I clicked open the older of the two unsolved cases. 2 years ago, a woman named Catherine Hayes had been killed outside her father's coffee shop on Knob Hill. Hayes, who worked for her father during the day, went to night school for accounting and finance. On that 12th day of May, she'd been having a smoke outside while talking to a friend on the phone when she'd been stabbed in the back. Then her throat had been slit. There were no witnesses, and the friend who had been on the phone with Hayes had heard only the victim's screams. Hayes hadn't been robbed. The killer took his knife and left nothing behind. No note, no DNA, no skin cells under the victim's nails. The leads were thinned and non-existent, and nothing panned out. Catherine Hayes left devastated friends and family, and her open file was still chilling. So was the file of Yolanda Pirro, a poet who'd been seen competing in last year's 12K Bay to Breakers race, a huge attraction that had been run annually for over 100 years. Many of the runners wore costumes. Some even ran nude, or dressed like fish and ran backward, as if they were swimming upstream. Go figure. Pirro's body was found the day after the race in a thicket of shrubs at the end of the course. She'd been wearing runner's gear, nothing that would make her stand out. Pirro had multiple stab wounds, any one of which could have been fatal. Her devastated husband and close circle of friends said she had no enemies. She was a poet who worked as a volunteer at a community garden and liked to run. She hadn't known Catherine Hayes, and the two women had no common friends, family, or acquaintances. The Northern District had caught the case and had no suspects and no witnesses, and at the same time, tens of thousands of suspects who'd participated in the race or watched from the sidelines. And so, without a clue, Yolanda Pirro's case went cold. The Pirro case reminded me a lot of Strickler. Lots of people in a crowd, but no witnesses. Including Tina Strickler, all three victims who were killed on Claire's birthday were attractive white females between the ages of 34 and 52, living within 3 densely populated miles of one another. Did anything connect them? Well, yes. They'd all been knifed. I was staring over my laptop, searching my mind for anything else that would link these three women's deaths, when someone kissed my temple. I put my arms up the way Julie does, and Joe gave me a big, crinkly smile and another kiss. He came around the sofa and sat down next to me.
"What are you doing?"
he asked. "Prowling around in some old case files."
"Oh, yeah? Why?"
I told him all about it. Chapter 11. My eyes opened at 3:15 a.m. Maybe the spicy pizza had given me a bad dream. Or maybe I just sensed that Joe was lying beside me with his eyes open. Either way, I knew something was wrong. I rolled over to face my husband and put my hand on his pajama sleeve. Joe, are you okay? He heaved a sigh that almost stirred the curtains across the room. Something was keeping him awake, but what? I quickly reviewed our evening at home, and apart from my asking him, "How was your day?" to which he'd answered, "Pretty good," our conversations had been all about my cases and me. That made me feel terrible. I shook his arm a little bit. "Joe, what's going on?" He said,
"I didn't mean to wake you."
"You didn't? What's wrong?" Joe sighed again, then plumped the pillows, rearranged the duvet, and drank some water. Then he said,
"Brooks Finley, that little shit. He fired me. Man, I was not expecting that."
"What? But why?"
"He gave no real explanation. Just change of direction, blah, blah, which was a lie. You're out. Your check's in the mail."
I was shocked by the news and equally blown away by how coldly Finley had axed my husband, and not just because what hurts Joe hurts me. I say this because Joe was Deputy Homeland Security Director. He is supremely knowledgeable, has a good bedside manner, and has top credentials from D.C. to the moon. Port authorities are his specialty. Brooks Finley, on the other hand, had gone from business school to an office job in L.A. If you ask me, hiring Joe might have been the highlight of Finley's career. Maybe he didn't like standing in Joe's shadow.
"I can't believe this, Joe. You were completely blindsided?"
"I had not a clue. If I'd screwed up, Finley would have been happy to tell me what, when, and how. So it's got to be that Finley doesn't like me. Or someone above Finley doesn't like me. It stinks. But it doesn't really matter."
"Why is that?" I asked.
"Because I'm not ready to retire. I'll get something better, but I have to close the door properly before the next door opens."
Joe grabbed his phone and tapped some keys.
Jeez, it was still only 3:30 a.m.
I heard a cracked voice at the end of the phone. My husband said,
"Brooks, it's Joe Molinari. Listen, you cut me off this morning, so I didn't get a chance to tell you. I had a breakthrough on the project." "Yeah, big one. Key to the whole damned puzzle. But you reminded me that we have a confidentiality agreement, so I deleted the work. Don't worry, I scrubbed the disk. The info is unrecoverable. No one will ever see it."
I could hear a squeaky protest coming over the phone, but I couldn't make out the words.
"No, no, that's all. I wanted to tell you that you didn't have to worry. It's like it never even existed. Sleep tight."
Joe clicked off the phone and said,
"You little prick."
He had a devilish Cheshire Cat grin on his face as he said to me,
"Now that was priceless."
Joe started to laugh, and I did too. Then he turned off the phone ringer and lay back down beside me. I pictured Finley cursing, trying to call back, getting the voicemail, getting nowhere. I fell asleep in my husband's arms, and when I woke up, Joe was in the kitchen with Julie and Martha, and he was making apple pancakes. It was a yummy start to what would turn out to be a very bumpy day. Chapter 12. Yuki was wrestling with a bear of a conflict as she parked her car in the wide-open parking lot at Fort Mason Center. She had a job interview with the Defense League at 10, and although they'd called her, she'd been borderline nauseated since she'd agreed to talk with them. The main reason for her queasiness was that she liked her job and she liked her boss, Leonard Red Dog Parisi, who had been her biggest booster. She hadn't told him or anyone else at the office that she was thinking of making a switch. So going on a job interview made her feel sneaky. Just as important, she also hadn't told Brady about the interview. Her husband was decisive and opinionated, and she wanted to make up her own mind before Brady had his say. And she was pretty sure he would tell her,
Do not take that job.
Yuki stared out at the always astonishing panoramic view of the bridge stretching across the glistening bay. Then she locked up her car and crossed the lot to a sidewalk running alongside one of the former fort's barracks. She passed several identical rusty brown doors before she saw the one marked the Defense League. Entering the office, Yuki gave her name to the young woman behind the plain wooden desk, took a wrapped peppermint from the dish, and sat down on one of six identical wooden chairs. Apart from the receptionist, Yuki was the only person in the small, unadorned, pretty close to shabby room. She couldn't help comparing this out-of-the-way place with the district attorney's office in the Hall of Justice. There, she was one of hundreds of legal professionals and cops working both sides of criminal cases all day, and most nights and weekends, too. The DA's office energized her, tested her, and plugged her into the heart of the San Francisco justice system, where she was finally beginning to distinguish herself. And thinking about all that made her wonder once again what in God's name she was doing here. But she knew. The one thing that nagged at her conscience was her growing awareness that people with money got far better representation in court than those without. Light years better. Nearly every day, some poor guy who'd been represented by an overworked and overwhelmed postgraduate public defender got out of jail after 20 long years because the DNA evidence came back saying he wasn't guilty. Yuki couldn't ignore her feeling that two-tiered justice wasn't really just. She'd been thinking quite often, really, that perhaps she should be doing something about this inequity. And then she'd gotten a call last week from Zach Jordan at the Defense League. Jordan had said,
"I've heard what a fighter you are, Ms. Castellano. I think we should talk."
It was 10 to 10, so Yuki used the few minutes of utter silence to review what she knew about this not-for-profit foundation, sponsored by a Secret Santa megabucks philanthropist. And she remembered a scrap of headhunter wisdom she'd relied on when she was looking for her first job. Get the job offer. Then you can always turn it down. A phone buzzed on the receptionist's desk. The young woman answered the call, then said,
"Miss Castellano, I can take you back to see Mr. Jordan now."
It was showtime. Chapter 13. Yuki gathered her impressions of the long-haired Mr. Jordan as he rose from his desk chair to greet her. He was in his late 20s, casually dressed in a nubby beige cotton pullover and jeans. He wore a wedding band and had a firm handshake, and his diploma from Harvard Law was inconspicuously placed on the wall, almost hidden by the hat rack. He definitely looked the part of a liberal-leaning do-gooder. In fact, Yuki liked him immediately. The two exchanged "nice to meet yous," and Mr. Jordan said,
"Please, call me Zach. Thanks for coming in. Have a seat."
"I haven't taken an interview in a long time, Zach. But I am aware of the Defense League and what you do here. I have to say, I'm intrigued."
"Intrigued by the opportunity to work long hours for low pay in a grubby office? Because I always find that to be a good recruiting tool."
Yuki laughed.
"Actually, my current job provides some of the same benefits."
Jordan smiled, then said,
"We've got a few perks I'll tell you about some other time, but first, let's talk about you. I've read your resume, and I have a few questions."
"Okay, shoot," Yuki said.
And then the laughs were over, and the real interview began. Zach Jordan asked about her first job in corporate law and her reasons for going to the DA's office. And then he started drilling down on the cases she'd worked from the beginning of her time with the DA. Yuki had lost nearly all the cases she'd prosecuted in her first 3 years, and Zach Jordan seemed to know each case as well as if he'd been sitting in the courtroom. He questioned her on every soft opening statement, every missed opportunity, every time opposing counsel had trampled her with superior litigation experience. Well, yeah, she'd been outgunned in several cases, but there were usually contributing factors. Faulty police work, a witness who changed her testimony, a defendant who committed suicide before Yuki made her closing argument. Depressing, deflating, not guilty verdicts had made her even more determined to sharpen her game, which she had done. Meanwhile, here she sat, having to defend her fairly pathetic win-loss ratio to a man she didn't know, who might or might not offer her a job she didn't necessarily want. When Zach Jordan dug into the infamous Del Norte ferry shooters trial, in which the defendant had killed 4 people and had been found legally insane, Yuki really had had enough. By definition, the shooter was crazy. But she had to try him for multiple homicides. That was her job. So she forced a smile and said to the hotshot across the desk from her,
"Well, gee, Zach, I have always done my best, and I've been promoted several times. I really don't understand why you asked to see me. Did you just bring me in so you could stick it to me?"
"Not at all. I needed to hear your side of these cases because we're always the underdogs. How would you feel about defending the poor, the hapless, and the hopeless?"
"I don't know," Yuki said, abandoning her plan to get the job offer, knowing that if she didn't want it, she could turn it down.
"See if this is of interest to you, Yuki,"
Zach said, handing her a file.
"I have a case that desperately needs to be tried. The victim was arrested outside a crack house where some dope slingers had been shot. He was running. He had a gun. The cops had probable cause to arrest him, but this kid was 15 and had a low IQ, and for some damned reason his parents weren't there. Although he maintained that he only found the gun, that it wasn't his, the cops muscled him into waiving his rights, and then he was squeezed until he gave a confession. While this poor schnook was awaiting trial, maybe a week after his arrest, he was murdered in jail. If he'd had a trial, he might have proven his innocence, and I do believe he was innocent. I believe he was victimized by the cops who interrogated him, and that he should never have gone to jail at all. I'm going to have to ask something of you, Yuki. Think about this overnight and see how you feel tomorrow morning. You're my first choice for this job, but I'm talking to someone else too, and I have to make a hire right away. Give me a call either way, okay?"
Chapter 14. Yuki had been lying awake in bed since Brady got up at 4 and started bumping into things as he tried to dress in the dark.
"You can turn on the light," she said.
"I'm good. My socks. I can't tell if they're blue or black even when the light is on."
He came to the side of the bed, sat on the edge of it, and kissed his wife.
"Why are you up?"
she asked him.
"A drug lab was shot to shit. Go back to sleep. I'll call you later."
Yuki thought, later might be too late. He was checking his gun, strapping on his shoulder holster.
"Brady?"
"Hmm?"
"Come here a sec."
He came back to the bed and stood above her in the dark, zipping up his windbreaker.
"I have to tell you something big,"
she said.
"I'm going to leave the DA's office."
"What? Yuki, what are you talking about?"
"I have a job offer with a not-for-profit. The Defense League. Impeccable credentials. I'll get the same salary, don't worry. But I'll be defending people with inadequate representation. They already have a case for me."
"Can we talk about this later?"
Brady said. He unhooked his phone from its charger and put it in his pocket.
"Sure, we can talk about it," she said. "But I've got to give the Defense League an answer."
"Today?"
"Yes. And I've got to tell Parisi before I accept, and he's on his way out of town at the end of the day."
Brady took his wallet off the dresser and put it in his back pocket. He was moving in a pretty herky-jerky fashion. Yuki read his body language. He was processing something he really didn't like. She knew her timing sucked.
"Sounds like you've made up your mind."
"It was sudden. I just met with the director yesterday, and I wanted to think about the offer overnight."
"Thanks for your faith in me."
Yuki trusted Brady with her life. This wasn't about faith in Brady.
"Okay,"
he said after 5 or 6 silent seconds had elapsed.
"I guess you should do what you want. I hope it works out for you."
"Brady, please don't be like this."
"People are waiting for me, hun. I'll see you later."
She listened to him leave the apartment, closing the door hard. She heard the door lock. And she heard her dead mother's voice inside her head.
"You hurt your husband's pride, Yukie. Why didn't you ask him if he approved of this move?"
She didn't have to answer her mother. She felt defiant, knowing that truly Brady would have pressured her out of the job, and he would have had valid reasons. He would have said it was good for her to work in the hall, to be near him. As a lifetime cop, he would have told her patiently that it was good for her to be part of the city government, where her job was secure, where she was moving up, making a reputation, and locking in a pension plan. He would have said that her hours might be long, but they were predictable. And he would have said that he wouldn't be able to stop worrying if she was working in bad neighborhoods. And he would have been right on all those points. But he would also have been wrong. Safe was good. But she had another idea about what she should be doing with her life and her abilities. She wanted to do work that would make her feel good about herself. Yuki looked at the clock, then slipped a sleep mask over her eyes. She tried to fall back to sleep, but there was no way. As bad as it was fighting with her husband, she couldn't stand thinking about what Red Dog was going to say to her. It wasn't going to be good. But she had to get it over with. Chapter 15. Yuki saw that Leonard Parisi's office door was open and that he was at his desk with its wide, uninspiring view of traffic and the handful of gritty, low-rent businesses on Bryant Street. Parisi's assistant was away from her post, so Yuki rapped on her boss's doorframe. He smiled at her and waved her in, pointing to the phone at his ear. She came inside and closed his door behind her. Then she took the chair across from him at his leather-topped desk and stared past his shoulder to the wall hanging behind him that showed the caricature of a big red dog gripping a bone in its teeth. Yuki had thought about what she was going to say to Len. She knew that in some ways it was as critical as an opening statement to a jury. Len was that important a person in her life. But she knew that once she'd made her speech, the meeting could go very wrong, depending on what Len said to her. Parisi was talking to a witness for an upcoming trial. The man had just had an emergency quintuple bypass. Yuki let her mind float until Parisi hung up the phone.
Sorry, Yuki. That was Josh Reynolds. He's not feeling too well.
Parisi himself had had a massive heart attack a few years ago. Yuki had been with him when it happened and had gotten medical assistance for him, PDQ. Later, he'd said she'd saved his life. It wasn't true, but she knew he felt that way. He certainly regarded her as a close friend, which was why having to tell him she was quitting was going to royally suck.
So what's on your mind?
He asked her.
Something wrong, Yuki?
Yuki gripped the edge of his desk and said,
Len, I got a job opportunity that I want to take.
There was dense, soundproof silence. Yuki could hear her words echoing in her head. She'd been honest, respectful, and direct. What was Len going to do now? Would he hug her? Or tell her to go fuck herself? He rocked back in his chair, then leaned forward, put his forearms on the desktop and clasped his hands, looking directly into her eyes. He said,
Aw, man, what terrible timing. You know I'm going away tonight for a week. There's just not enough time for me to get you a counteroffer today, but I will put it in motion. Give me some ammo. What kind of job? How much are they offering?
That's so nice of you, Len, but I don't want a counteroffer. I don't want to leave either.
Well, don't. Problem solved.
She smiled.
But I need to do it. It's the Defense League, and there's an urgent case that I feel drawn to. I think I'll regret it if I turn this opportunity down.
The Defense League. Really? You'd rather go into a non-profit than stay here? I thought we had the same goals for this office. You've been working the best cases. I mean, not just Brinkley. I gave you Herman, too. I had to fight off piranhas to do that. Every ADA in the office wanted a piece of that guy.
I know. I know, Len, and I don't want you to think I'm not grateful.
Yuki, speaking from personal experience, let me just say that a near-death event changes a person. I know that's what happened to you. You're still processing that you could have died, and for someone your age, that's heavy. You will feel differently in 6 months, I promise. Turn down the offer. Let me work on making this a dream job,